My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism. But I got some opinions. I want to thank the committee for asking me. It's great. I went and saw where Lincoln lived and where he's living now. Bill lives in Bloomington. He'd never been there, so I showed it to him. He liked it. He's going to go back, he said. I've had a great time. This is a wonderful conference, and I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here. God, I wish I could remember what I said in Bloomington 3 years ago. It must have been really something, you know? Yeah. Oh, boy. I've been sober 20 years, and I never planned on this. I mean, I just didn't have a clue it was going to happen. And if I'd have known I was going to be sober this long, I really would have worked at being a better example. But it just kind of happened to me, and I wish I had some wisdom for you. But all I got is experience, and it's just my experience, and so it's peculiar to me. But what I'm finding out the more I travel around this country is the reason they get me to share is not because I'm unique, but because I'm pretty typical. As much as I'd like to think that my case is different, I have found out over the years that I'm a fairly ordinary, tacky, garden variety drunk. You know, just nothing terribly imaginative about me or bright or interesting or cute or anything. I just, the reason I'm here is that I drank like a pig and I loved it. And I arrived, and boy, I would sure love to pin it on a whole lot of people, you know, the reason I'm standing here. You know, my father was a drunk, and I'd like to blame it on him, but he didn't think it was a terrific idea for me to drink a quart of scotch a day. He didn't think it was a great idea for him to drink a quart of scotch a day. He certainly didn't want his eldest son to do it. No doctor ever gave me a prescription and said, please abuse these. You know, that was my idea. You know, it was my idea to smoke and ingest a whole lot of outside issues and to get into all the trouble I got into, you know. And of course, when I arrived and got kind of clear, I decided it must have been their fault, but it isn't. And since the progress of the disease is my fault, the progress of my sobriety is my responsibility. And so I've been working on it. I've been working on it because I got tired of committing suicide on a daily basis. And what you promised me was an extraordinary thing. And I'm here to tell you that if you're new, don't bother making any plans. Just don't bother making any plans. And the reason we tell you that is we're afraid that's all you'll get. Because what I have found in this program and what I have found in this fellowship and found with people like you is beyond anything that I ever dreamed of. You come to with a sharp intake of breath. That's how drunks wake up, you know? And the alarm clock is across the room, because if it's right here, you'll just bash it and you'll never wake up and you'll be late for whatever you need to be, you know? So if you got to get up and go across the room and turn off the alarm clock, there's a 50-50 chance you won't go back to bed, you know? And there you are standing there, and your day has begun. And if you're like me, you got a hangover and what's starting to seep through is a remembrance of some of the things, little flashes of what you did the night before. And if you're the kind of drunk that I was, you get stumbled to the bathroom and you boil yourself in the shower for 3/4 of an hour. So they won't know, you know? You can always tell the drunk's bathroom, the ceiling's peeling, you know, from the steam, you know? God! I would come out of that thing with second-degree burns, you know, just try to recover. Now, my father was a drunk, and I knew that if you drank in the morning, you were drunk. So what I would do in the mornings is I would open my medicine cabinet, and I would take some of those pretty things, you know. I'd take some of those things that kind of get me up and get me going, and then another thing that would kind of put a topper on it so it was kind of smoothed out on top so that I could make it through. And then I would get into the kitchen, you know. I'd get it all together and get to the kitchen and open my refrigerator, and it usually had orange juice and a bottle of vodka. And you can't touch that bottle of vodka, man, because if you touch that in the morning, you're drunk, you know. So I'd get the orange juice down, or I'd have a glass of water, and I'd be drunk again. And God, I hated that. That was terrifying to me, you know. And I try to eat something, get something in my stomach, you know, just to stop the whips and the jangles, you know, because I was a little quick in the morning. When that stuff hit your stomach, you know, you kind of move it, you know. And I get to work and start on the coffee. And so I was whipping around all morning. And then we go to lunch, and I was in sales, of course, you know. God. You know, guys would say, want a beer? And I'd say, no. And they say, God, he's a great guy. He doesn't drink, you know. The only reason I didn't drink at lunch is that I knew if I had a drink at lunch, I'd never get back to the office. I'd never make it, you know. The day would be swept away, so I'd tough it up, man. I was one of those ones who didn't drink during the day. So I get back to the office, and I always had a little pill box with me, and I'd take something else to kind of calm me down, you know, get me through that afternoon, you know, and maybe something a little upper to kind of, you know, because I'd start to nod, you know, and you got to keep it up. And then I'd get home, and it was 5 o'clock, man. And 5 o'clock, I could drink. That was okay. And I'd start. And by 6:30, I'd be drunk. By 7 o'clock, I'd slip into a blackout. And I'd exist or do whatever I did, you know, and I would go out and do or stay home or do and, you know, do it. And, you know, 11, 12, 1 o'clock, I'd pass out, you know. Then I'd come to with a sharp intake of breath and get up and go across the room and turn off the alarm clock, and that's the kind of pitiful little goddamn life I led. And I did it because alcohol worked for me every time I used it. The reason I'm standing here is that I loved to drink. I absolutely loved it. I've heard people from podiums talk about the fact that it stopped working for them, and if it ever stopped working for me, I'd have quit a long time ago. If it had stopped working for me, I'd have stopped doing it. But I got to tell you, from the first time I did it at 14 years old to the last drink the night before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a moment where it all came together. There was a moment, you know? Have you ever heard a smoke alarm going off in another room? You know what that sounds like? It's kind of just below the surface. You don't really hear it, you know? It kind of comes into your consciousness after it's been going on for a long time. When I was 14 years old, I had a belt of Southern comfort, and that sound stopped. And I had been living with that sound all my life. Whatever it was that caused me the kind of pain that I lived with, the kind of psychic pain, was like that noise. And when I had that drink, it stopped. It stopped. Now, the huge mistake I made as an alcoholic and as a secretive, you know, because by the time I was 14 years old, I had become secretive about my problems. I had recognized that nobody was particularly interested in what was wrong with me. So I stopped telling people. I stopped discussing it because there wasn't any solution for me anyway. But what I thought was the absence of pain was freedom. I thought the absence of pain was joy. I thought that well into sobriety, you know? And the absence of pain is simply, it simply means that it's kind of normal, you know? When a wound stops hurting, it doesn't mean that it's healed. And I thought that's what it meant. But after the second drink or the third drink, or there was some magic combination in there, there was a moment when it all happened for me, you know? When it all came together, when I was tough but tender, you know? Kind of sexy but sensitive, you know? A tough guy and a poet, you know? A nasty sense of humor with something bittersweet underneath it, you know? Just a really interesting, kind of fabulous guy. I love feeling like that. I love being that guy, you know? And then what would happen is that kind of, you know, ever watch Star Trek when they achieve warp speed? You know, they just go, whoosh, you know? And something would happen. I mean, all of a sudden it was, whoa, it was 2 hours later, you know? And I'd come out of a blackout, and there would be people standing around going, you know, God, I love that, you know. And I had done something, you know, I had done it. One of my favorite kind of Christmas stories is as a young up-and-coming actor in New York, I got invited to a very, very important party on the east side of Manhattan at a very, very spiffy address with some important people in the theater. I mean, it was a career move, this invitation. I got invited by a girl that I'd been dating, and she was, I don't know, anyway. I had a cold. I loved colds. I don't know about you, because colds afforded me the opportunity to take large amounts of terpenhydrate of codeine. So I anticipated colds with a kind of glee, you know. I kind of stand out in the rain a lot, hoping I get a cold. Yeah. So I had a cold that night, and this was a very important party, so I was nervous, you know, and I needed to just kind of calm down, so I took a little something, and then I had three belts, you know, and I don't know about you, but if I was invited to a party with three people that I'd known for 40 years, I needed three belts just to kind of get in the room. I hate getting in rooms. God, I hate walking in. I hated walking in this room. I hate walking in rooms. Yeah. And so I had a little kind of thing to calm me down. So when I arrived at this party, I was together. Together, you know? A happening talent in New York theater. And this apartment, the elevator opened and it was the only apartment on the floor. I mean, it was one of those apartments. And then the double doors opened and right across the foyer was the hostess's pride and joy. Every year the hostess did a Christmas tree. And this Christmas tree was, you know, all it needed was a skating rink. I mean, every year it had a theme and it was photographed, it was all that kind of thing, you know. And so I, you know, it was beautiful. And I stopped by the bar and got a drink and, you know, and then, woof, you know, I just, suddenly it was an hour later, you know. And I was standing looking at the Christmas tree with this strange sound behind me. It sounded like somebody had slit somebody's throat. You know, that kind of intake of breath going through a severed tube kind of sound. It was really kind of interesting, you know. And what it was the hostess going, because it seems in my blackout that I had kind of reflocked her Christmas tree. And I was dabbing at it with a napkin, trying to kind of clean it up, you know. And the entire party of the most important people in New York theater had stopped talking and were looking at me at the Christmas tree. And the wonderful thing about being a drunk is sometimes blackouts come back, you know? And I don't remember what happened after that. I was told later that I handed my drink to her, apologized, and walked straight out of the house, you know? But those are the kind of things that I did a lot. Nothing particularly interesting, you know? I never came to in Kuala Lumpur. I never stole a tugboat. I never went to death row like a regular guy at AA, you know? I just did a series of tacky, embarrassing, shabby, sleazy, nasty, boring, slimy little things over and over and over again, interspersed with occasional spectacular achievements. And if you looked at them, you'd have thought it was probably, you know, I did these incredible things to impress you with how much better than you I was. But that was never true. I was coming from so far behind that I figured if I did something extraordinary, you'd think that I was equal to you. You know, and after that moment that alcohol, you know, did for me, and that combinations of stuff did for me, at some time during the evening, you know, I would come to the next day, and it was like I had swallowed a weed eater, you know, and it had just kind of chopped my guts up from the inside. Didn't show on the outside, but I was shredded on the inside, and that's what the disease of alcoholism did to me. And I kept doing it because that moment, oh God, that wonderful moment. The only problem was I kept paying a higher and higher and higher price for it, and eventually the price simply crushed me. And I was forced to look at it because of my self-imposed crisis. I made all kinds of moves to avoid coming to here. I never really was looking forward to spending 20 years in church basements, let me tell you. You know? I never at any moment during my drinking thought, what I need to do is take a fearless and thorough moral inventory. I mean, I just never was high up on my list. I just, you know, just never wanted to really ever do that, you know? But I made all the moves, you know? God, briefly, my drunkalog is this. I started getting drunk when I was 14 years old. I started taking drugs when I was 17 years old. By the time I was 18 years old, I declared myself an alcoholic. I didn't know that I'd done it, but I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says. If you've ever said it, you're an alcoholic. If you've ever heard anybody say it, you're listening to an alcoholic, and the phrase is, I can control my drinking. That's like saying, I am an alcoholic. You know? And I said that when I was 18 years old. Social drinkers never deal with that concept. Social drinkers, if they do something stupid or tacky whilst drinking, they stop drinking. I think that's very weird, but I mean, because you can always try it one more time, you know? And it'll be all right next time. I just know that. Yeah? By the time I was 20 years old, I was a daily drinker, and I continued to do that until I was 31 and a half, and I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous on April 24th, 1974, and I've been here ever since, 52, if you're trying to put all those figures together. And along the way, I did everything I could to avoid coming here. I went to psychiatrists, I was always going to moral superiors to try to get help. You know, I went to priests and Christian brothers and nuns and monsignors and bishops and psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers and religious gurus and, you know, meditation and yogis and inspirational lecturers and policemen and judges and lawyers. And I told them... I told them my problem, you know, and some of them were really earnest and some of them were really knowledgeable, and what they did was they consulted their books and they said, this is what you should do about your problem, and anybody points a finger at me and says, this is what you should do about your problem, I'd bite their finger off at the knuckle. And what happened is eventually I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what you said is, this is what I've done about my problem, and I could listen to that. You said a phrase before that that made it possible for me to learn. And it is the only place that I've been able to learn, because you're the only people who have ever said this to me, and it makes you miracle workers. And the phrase is, I know how you feel. Nobody ever said that before I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you have always known precisely how I feel. And that's all I was ever looking for. I was looking for a place to be understood and accepted so that I could settle down enough to learn how in God's name you live when you have to give up that moment. Now, when I arrived here, I understood that that moment was gone for me. I was never going to feel that way again. I knew that to be true. And I was angry, and I was hurt, and I thought, you better come up with something real fast. And you did. Along the way, I decided what I needed was a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. And we started our dance of death, and... We have been together for 25 years, and my life is graced by a member of Al-Anon. She has been actively participating in the fellowship of Al-Anon for 20 years, as have I. And an Al-Anon is not merely somebody who is married to an alcoholic. An Al-Anon is somebody who embraces the steps, the traditions of Al-Anon, who works the program, who attends meetings, who is active in service. And I am married to one of those ladies, and I got to tell you, it's been incredible. But before we got here, we damn near killed each other. And we didn't know we were doing it. We were trying to do it. You know, we were trying to be the best we could be, you know. If love could cure alcoholism, I wouldn't need to be here, because I've been well-loved for a long time. Al-Anons are the most loving people in the world. It's all just misdirected. That's their problem, you know. I mean, once it gets refocused, it's incredible, you know, but But somewhere along the line, drinking had ceased to be a luxury for me and was now a necessity. And it was medicinal. It was something that kept it together for me, and I needed to do it. And in order to maintain an addiction of that kind of stuff, you've got to shift responsibility. And the closest one to do that was with my wife. And so I would help her to become a better human being, to realize her full potential. I would say things to her like, "Oh, you're going to wear that dress. You know I've always liked your hair the other way. I don't think you should have said that at dinner, darling. I think you upset the hostess." You know, helpful things so that she could become a better human being. And a clear message in it was that if she was taller, if she was shorter, if she was a redhead, if she was a brunette, if she worked, if she stayed home, if she wrote poetry, if she cooked, if she gardened, if she was somehow different, I wouldn't need to drink. And the sad thing about people who love alcoholics is she bought that. And she started to take it on. She started to take on the responsibility, and the disease of alcoholism started to have its effect on the person closest to me. And I watched this wonderful, feisty, great, talented, funny, bright lady start to shrivel in front of me. And by the time we arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, if you looked at us as a couple, it was very, very clear that she was the one in desperate trouble. Yeah. The aspects of the problem of Al-Anon were just manifold in her. She wouldn't get her hair done, so she wore her hair in kind of babushkas all the time, and she wouldn't buy any new clothes, so she wore these kind of shapeless kind of tent dresses, and her nails were bitten to the quick, and her lips were disappearing. That happens to Al-Anons. I mean, their lips, you know, there just ain't anything funny by the time they arrive here, you know? And she was angry all the time, and I was always kind of just fine, man, you know? I mean, she was so uptight. I used to say, "For God's sake, have a glass of wine and a Valium and chill out, you know? God, yeah?" About 6 months before I got to this fellowship, we had a vicious fight. I've never been a physically violent alcoholic. I'm an emotionally violent alcoholic. I have a shark-infested mouth. And I said some vicious, vicious things that night before I passed out. I was in a blackout. I still don't remember what they are. She does, and she has had the good taste and enough of a program never to discuss them with me, and I'm grateful for that. But it was sad. You know, an alcoholic marriage is a carefully choreographed dance. You know, somehow both partners know just how far you can push it before it's going to blow up, and then you back off from it. And you hint that you're going to say the thing that'll do it, and then you pull back a little, you know, and you do that kind of clenched teeth thing, you know, it gets really vicious and gets real close, and then you back, you know, and that kind of emotional violence destroys people. And by the time we arrived, she was pretty much destroyed. On April 23rd, 1974, I was arrested by the West Hollywood Vice Squad on a sleazy charge. We had moved to L.A. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance, with the front of my pants from the waistband to the knees soaked in my own urine, and it got my attention. And that night I had a series of revelations about myself, which I now understand was a spiritual experience. I have always missed my spiritual experiences in my life because I've always been looking for spiritual events. I wanted the wind to blow up my ass like Bill Wilson, you know? Has never happened. You know, I never saw the white light, none of that stuff, you know? I just have these changing directions in my life, and about 6 months later, I look back and go, oh. But that night, I saw that there was an enormous gap between who I was and who I wanted to be, and I couldn't find any way to bridge that gap. You see, because I've always known the kind of human being I should be. I was raised by a family that taught me morals and ethics. I was raised in a society that taught me morals and ethics. I have always known what was right and wrong. I have always known that. What had happened is because of the use and abuse of alcohol and drugs, I lived outside of my own moral boundaries for a very, very long time. I had profound feelings of guilt when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was no mystery. The reason I felt guilty was because I was guilty. No magic to that one, man. I was living the kind of life that I didn't approve of. And And I saw that I had somehow committed suicide of the soul. My entire spiritual life, by the time I arrived here on April 24th, 1974, consisted of those two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, "Dear God, get me out of this and I will never do it again." And the second alcoholic prayer is, "Phew." That was the extent of my spiritual life. Now, I got to tell you that I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous on April 24th, 1974, without insurance. I shook it out in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I have never had a drink and a drug since that day. So if you are new, you only got to do this once. And let me tell you, how many here are in your first year of sobriety? Let me see your hands. Right. How do you like it so far? Right? Getting sober was the worst experience of my adult life. I never want to do it again as long as I live. The reason I stay sober is, there's a lot of reasons I stay sober, but one of the main reasons is I never want to have to get sober again. You know? So if you're new, sit down, shut up, and listen as hard as you can, and stay here. Drinking and using is no longer an option. So anyway, I've been doing this thing ever since I got here. I didn't know you could slip. You know, I never heard about those relapse classes they have, you know? And thank God I never heard of them. You know, thank God. One of the wonderful things that happened to me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is I got struck stupid. I didn't know what the hell you were talking about when I arrived here. It took me months to figure out what you were talking about. This was the weirdest place I'd ever been in my life. My first meeting was terrifying. I got to tell you how I arrived at my first meeting. I had a $250 sports jacket from Saks Fifth Avenue. This is in 1974. I had on French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and a designer tie. I had been paid $300 for a day's work as a model about a week before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked fabulous at my first AA meeting. I walked in. It was amazing. And every one of you knew that I was a drunk. Well, I couldn't figure that out. There were a couple of things going on that I hadn't been aware of. One of them was that it was a rather warm evening. And I'd been drinking straight vodka the night before, and I had on a lot of lemon-lime cologne, and I smelled like a gimlet. And the other thing that was going on was I had newcomer eyes. Now, the only other place I've ever seen eyes like that, other than on a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, are on a dog loose on a freeway. I was terrified. Coming to my first meeting was like being dropped into a shark tank. I'd never seen so many teeth coming at me in my life. It must have been a real slow night for newcomers, because you all just went, "Ha!" You know? Whoa! And he got up real close, and I noticed right off the bat he would shake my hand and he wouldn't let go. Held onto my hand. You were the touchiest, feeliest bunch I'd ever met, you know, and it was pretty strange, and you got up real close and you whispered stuff, you know, like, "Easy does it, easy does it, easy does it." I was coming off everything. I was twitching, and you were telling me to easy does it, you know, keep coming back. Obviously, you hadn't noticed the fingerprint ink that was still on, yeah? One day at a time. I had to go to court in 3 weeks. What do you mean one day at a time, for God's sake? But it was amazing at that meeting. I felt safe. I felt safe for the first time in my life, you know? And I had developed that thing that I, you know, I came into this fellowship with that combination that protects you, you know, it's kind of cynical and terrified, that combination. And I was trying to act nice so that, you know, I mean, clearly I could look around and, I mean, there were some people with some real problems there. And I was basically really pissed off that my best friend had been taken away from me, and clearly we were talking one day at a time for the rest of my life. And I was never going to get to feel like that again. And I mean, I was angry and I was upset and I was scared and I was trying to be charming. And you know, it's real interesting. I see people coming into AA and they, we either come in angry or terrified. And it's one of the two, you know. And underneath it all for me, and I don't know whether it was like this for you, but underneath it all for me, I was saying very, very quietly, please, please let me stay here. Please, just let me sit down and be quiet. I won't take up any room, and I won't make any noise, and I won't cause you any problem, but for God's sake, don't throw me away. Please, I've been thrown away so much. I've thrown myself away. Please, just let me stay. And the wonderful thing about the loving people in Alcoholics Anonymous is you heard that. You knew what that sound was. No matter what kind of sounds I was making, you could hear that sound. And you let me stay. You gave me my chair that I'd bought and paid for. You gave me a half a cup of coffee, and you started sharing your life. Now, that had started that afternoon because I had said the last phrase on that afternoon about 11 o'clock. I'd said to a woman I'd been working with who had 6 years of sobriety, I'd been watching her for a year, and I knew she was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was having a hell of a good time. I mean, she had good days and bad days, but she had a great time, you know? And I had said to her, I'm an alcoholic, and I got 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And she heard the screaming. And she 12-stepped me. She did a classic 12-step. She dropped everything. She canceled all her appointments for that afternoon. She bought me a sandwich. She took me to her apartment. She sat me down at her dining room table, and she 12-stepped me. She got out the big book. She told me her story. She read to me from the big book. She explained to me what Alcoholics Anonymous was. She asked me if I had problems with a concept of God. It didn't matter what it was, but did I have any kind of concept? And I said yes, and she said, that'll make things easier. And I explained to her that the drinking was killing me, and I understood it, but that I felt that the best thing for me would be kind of drift into Alcoholics Anonymous on a little pink cloud of Valium, you know, just kind of touch down. You know. Because I knew that because of all the drugs that I'd been taking and all that I'd been indulging in, that withdrawal would probably kill me. I didn't have insurance, so I couldn't go to one of those places. And in 74, there weren't a lot of those places. We still had to do things like break a guy's toe to get him into emergency, you know, because you couldn't get him in for alcoholism, that kind of nonsense. But so I explained that to her. And I thank God that I explained it to her, because she had had a similar story. And what she told me on April 24th, 1974, is what we consider sobriety is clean and sober. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, that means we do not drink and we don't take any self-administered mind-altering chemicals. And I really want to thank her for telling me that, because if she hadn't made that clear, I probably wouldn't have made it. Because by the time I arrived here, it had gotten all mixed up with me. I am a child of the 60s, and we're the generation that made drug abuse middle class. We're the generation that, according to some of the old-timers, messed up a perfectly respectable disease. But we were also the generation that, by the time we crawled into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, luckily there were a few ahead of us who made it clear to us that sobriety maybe had to be a little more stringent for us than it was for some of the old-timers. And I thank God for them, because it was true for me, and it seems to be truer these days. This conference is about service, and this conference is about what is happening to Alcoholics Anonymous as an organization in 1994. And as an organization, we reflect the human condition, and we reflect what is going on in society. And luckily, the people who wrote the big book had enough humility to say, we realize we know only a little. More will be revealed to you and to us. And over the years, we have found out more stuff. We found out more stuff about us and about the kind of people that are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. We have seen the rise of treatment centers. We have seen treatment centers have been very beneficial for a lot of people getting sober. But they also have usurped a lot of the 12-step work of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have also undermined the sponsorship role in Alcoholics Anonymous. And unfortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous at times has given the appearance of affiliating. While not doing it, it's very difficult for newcomers not to make that difference. And we have given up a lot of what we do. What's happening now, of course, is insurance companies are getting pretty disgusted with us drunks, and they're starting to pull back on those 28-day vacations. And so we're starting to get them pretty fresh, still damp again. You know, it's kind of nice. Kind of nice. That little thing is kind of reversing. But over the years, in order to fill hospital beds, a lot of those treatment centers have made it very muddy as to what the disease of alcoholism is. And so we have a lot of people coming into this fellowship are very, very confused about what singleness of purpose is. And I believe as members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we've got to look at ourselves and how we react to that. And unfortunately, in some parts of the country, there are people who are reacting very badly to it. There are old-timers who are pulling away from the fellowship because they're afraid that people are trying to take over Alcoholics Anonymous. Non-alcoholics are trying to take over Alcoholics Anonymous. I got some news for you. Nobody aspires to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, who in God's name would want us, for Christ's sake, you know? And some of them are reacting very badly. There are places where old-timers are pulling away from the fellowship and meeting in private houses with little invited groups of pure alcoholics. They must have groups of four or five at those meetings, you know? I, unfortunately, am one of those impure ones and not unique. Now, the big book talks about the fact that nobody wants to be a real alcoholic. I mean, they talked about that in 1936 when they wrote the 39, whatever, when they wrote the big book. Nobody wants to be a real alcoholic. Now, the chicest way not to be a real alcoholic these days is to be, it's got a little more panache. It's got a little more style, you know? And so I've heard, you know, I get to talk to a lot of addicts. Have you ever talked to a lot of addicts? It's really wonderful. First of all, you have to think metric when you're talking, you know? It's all in grams and kilos. I mean, just trying to figure out the amounts is hard, you know? And the other thing is they're all dealers. I don't know who the hell was buying. I mean, they were all selling. You know, it's just amazing, you know. Yeah. So they start stumbling into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they say, I'm an addict. You know, well, okay, that's terrific. You're an addict. Come to our open meetings. Come to our open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Sit down, shut up, and listen, you know. And let's not have anybody get real excited and say, no addicts here, get out. I mean, we don't need to throw anybody out, for God's sake. So what happens is the guy is an addict and he gets to come to these open meetings and he listens to the causes and conditions and he starts hearing the feelings, you know, and maybe along the line, you know, he'll get honest enough to admit that he maybe drank a little. I had a friend of mine that I worked with for a long time. He called me one day and he said, listen, Sean, I'm in AA and I've been in AA for 6 months. And I said, that's terrific, Larry. And he said, let's have lunch. And I said, terrific. So we went and had lunch and he said, you know, I feel like a fraud. And I said, why is that, Larry? And he said, well, it was mainly cocaine. And I said, oh, really? So then he told me his drug log, you know. And he said, and then I would get up in the morning and I would put a tumbler full of scotch in the microwave and then I'd take a shower and then I'd, you know, and then I'd get on with my day. And I said, wait, hold on, wait a minute. Back that up again. Now, what'd you do in the morning? He said, well, I'd put a tumbler full of scotch in the microwave and take my shower and then I'd, you know, it would warm it up so it would stay down. I said, I see. Okay. I got to tell you something, Larry. I was a puking, blackout drunk. And I never, ever did that. I said, if that's the only thing that you did, you would qualify for the fellowship, so cut the cocaine crap and join it, you know? So we did. Became secretary of a meeting shortly after that, you know? So anyway, when that happens, when they start getting comfortable with the idea that they're not going to get thrown out, what happens is they'll admit to being addict alcoholic. Fine. As soon as you say alcoholic, you get to read chapter 5, you know? You get to actually participate. You get to be part of this thing, you know, and you may pick up a sponsor, you know. And after you start doing the steps, you know, and you get to the fourth and fifth, you do it with your sponsor, and you start admitting that you drank a lot, you know. Your sponsor kind of lets you into it, you know, and then you see the guy start identifying as an alcoholic addict, you know. It flips that little thing now, you know, still sending out that message that his case is a little different, you know, than you old farts, just a little different, you know. Hyper-alcoholic here, yeah? I know, because I did it. And then what happens is he's at a business meeting, he goes to the bathroom, and he gets elected GSR. Yeah? And suddenly he's in service, you know? He's going to all these assemblies, you know, and they're starting to talk about prudent reserve and singleness of purpose and all that kind of stuff. And eventually he comes in contact with the traditions. And if he stays in service long enough to understand how they work, eventually he becomes an alcoholic. Because what he eventually comes to understand is that this is called Alcoholics Anonymous. And Anonymous is as important as Alcoholics. And what Anonymous is, it's a spiritual principle. And it is a principle where I give up my need to distinguish myself, either within this fellowship or out there. What I do with the spirit of anonymity is give up the necessity to point out to you that I am different than you are. What it does is it allows me to explore how I'm the same. And once I do that, I place myself in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I do that, I get to access the only thing that I can really recover with, and that is sober experience. It doesn't matter what your religious dogma is or your psychological theories or any of those kind of things. The thing that saves lives here is one alcoholic sharing his sober experience with another alcoholic. We talk about our drunkologues just to identify with each other. But then sooner or later, we've got to get on with this thing. Now, the resource that is most important are those old dudes, those old guys, those old pure alcoholics, you know? Those old guys who are sitting back there with 35, 40 years under their belt. Those guys who have lived through famine, death, war, and pestilence and stayed sober. Those guys who have been married for a long time and stayed sober. Those guys who know how to hold down jobs. Those guys who know all that kind of stuff that I need to know. So if I stop pointing out to them that I'm different than they are, then I get to get close to them. Because, you know, once you've been in this program a while and you're sponsoring a lot of people, there's only just so much time that you got. So what you do is you work with the ones who tell you they're the same as you are. So if you're new and you're trying on these triple and double and quadruple identifications, cut the crap. Join the fellowship. Now you old dudes who are sitting here stomping on singleness of purpose because these newcomers scare you, let me tell you something. You put yourself and your sobriety in great danger if you withhold your sober experience because you do not approve of how we got here. Like it or not, pure alcoholics are a diminishing resource of 12-step work. You are stuck with us. You're going to have to work with us because we're in service now. We ain't going away. I don't know about your meetings, but we don't spend a hell of a lot of time talking about how we got here. We spend a lot of time talking about how you stay here. You know? What are the principles? What are the steps? What are the traditions? And how the hell do I apply them in my life? And so I've been working on them for a long time. Because I got a wife who's in this fellowship. And I got people in this fellowship. And I've been active in this fellowship. And eventually, once you get through the 12 steps, and I've done them over and over and over again because I'm actively involved in my recovery, you get to the point at the back of that 12th step where it says we practice these principles in all our affairs. And eventually we got to do it, you know? Because the 12th step is the promise of the first 11. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps is the promise from the second step. A spiritual awakening in terms of an alcoholic is being restored to sanity. That's what it is. That's what it is. And if you have diligently worked the first 11 steps with a sponsor and have done those things, you've been restored to sanity. Now, the problem with that is, if I've been restored to sanity, I can't cop to being crazy anymore. It's no longer a cop-out to me. I can't come to you and say, I just shot my mother, but I'm sober. You know? It doesn't work. It doesn't cut it. Once I hit the 12th step, I am responsible. I have been restored to sanity. I know what's right. I know what's wrong. I have done my 4th and 5th step. I've done my 8th and 9th step. I'm working on building a spiritual life. I am as good as I'm going to get. Here I am, folks. Now, what do I do? The second part talks about carrying the message to other people, to practicing alcohol, to other alcoholics, and I do that. And then that little one at the end. Practice these principles in all our affairs. Now, I live in a family. When I was 8 years sober, my daughter was born. Now, you have beautiful and intelligent children, but I have Kate. She is now 12 years old. She's 5'4". She shaves her legs. And the mouth breathers are about to show up on my front lawn. And I got a feeling my program's about to go out the window. But she's great. She's a great kid. But we got a family. And what I had to look at, it's really interesting, you know, because I'm, you know, working the 12 steps at first is just, you know, it's just more of the disease, the self-obsession of getting recovered. You know, I'm just, you know, it's all, you know, how do I do this? How do I get better? How do I, you know. And what happens is, if you're really lucky enough to go to the bathroom during a business meeting and get elected GSR and get into service on that level, I hope you have the experience that I had. And the experience that I had being in service, in general service, was that I came to understand that while my sobriety is the central issue of my life, your sobriety collectively is more important than mine is. That without you, I can't do it. I cannot do it. I'm 20 years sober, and I stand here to tell you that to this day, I am capable of honest self-deception. I can absolutely convince myself with 20 years of sobriety that something that is totally wrong for me is absolutely right. I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. You know? I got to check it out with you. I got to check it out with you. I got to watch you. I've got to practice these principles. And the problem with Alcoholics Anonymous is it's like Chinese food. It just doesn't stick with you, man. You know? I learned something profound at a meeting. 3 weeks later, I got to come back and say, you remember what you told me 3 weeks ago? Would you tell that to me again? You know? I've got a sponsor to this day. You know, I got a sponsor. I need a guy who knows me well to tell me I'm about to do it again. You know? I need... so that I don't have to do it again. I need somebody to tell me I'm about to, so I don't have to do it again. You know, I've had a lot of slips in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of slips in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, a drink is the end of the slip. A slip is a high arcing dive into a drink. And it starts with me noticing that you don't quite understand what I'm telling you. That your responses are not quite on target. That I know the speaker's real story. And if Mr. Serenity would stop boffing newcomers, he'd be a hell of a lot better. You know, all that nonsense, you know? I mean, it starts with that. And so I start pushing my way out of this fellowship, you know? And luckily, I've had a sponsor all through my sobriety who says, whoops, hold it. You know, what are the principles here? What are the principles? And so I try to apply these traditions in my family. And I just want to share some of that with you, you know. Tradition one is our family's common welfare should come first. Personal recovery is aided by unity. What I had to do in my family is we have to sit down and do the first tradition. Which is what we say is, the three of us sit down and we say, okay, where's this family going? What are we trying to do here? Who are we? What do we collectively believe in? What is the unity in this family? You know? What are the long-term goals? That's tradition one in working hard in our little thing. For our family's group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our family's group conscience. Parents are but trusted servants. They do not govern. And let me tell you, I try to govern occasionally. You know? I want you to do it and do it now. You know? I want to bark out some orders and get to it and get it done. You know? Instead of that, I got to lead by example if I'm working in the second tradition. I got to be a parent. I got to be the one that leads it. Children don't respond to language. They respond to action. They respond to emotion. And they watch it and they feel it. And they watch how I act. You can't teach honesty to children. You got to be honest for them to understand it. And so I don't try to govern. And unfortunately, in my family, I get reminded of that when I do try. The only requirement for family membership is a desire to be part of that family. I have relatives who are not part of my family. You know, they are merely relatives. I have people that I have no blood relationship to who are part of my family, because what they do is they believe in and support what I'm doing. I don't find it necessary to be, you know, unpleasant to anybody who doesn't do that. But my family has been redefined because of these principles. Now, each member should be autonomous, except in matters that affect other family members, other members and the family as a whole. What we try to do is we try to understand that each of us have individual rights, each of us have individual opinions, and each of us have individual interests. We got lots of things going on. You know, for instance, my daughter likes to fly in a trapeze. She does that occasionally. Scares the hell out of me. I'm not the least bit interested in doing it. I like to collect old cars. Nothing bores my wife more than to drive 2 hours to look at some old Packard that's leaking on somebody's lawn, you know? So she lets me do that by myself, you know? So we are individuals in our family, and it's important that we have that autonomy. When we are about to make major decisions, we sit down and discuss them with it. No one person is the authority in our family. We have one primary purpose in our family, and that's to be mutually supportive. When I was 5 years sober, I blew up my family and my marriage again. I was very sober when I was 5 years sober, and I decided to explore the fence lines of my sobriety. I wanted to find out exactly how much rope I had before I would hang myself, and I went to explore some very, very old ideas. And what happened is that I got arrested again and went to jail. It's not as interesting when you're cold sober and you're Mr. AA. And when I came home that night, Bonnie came home from rallying on me, and she walked in and said, "My God, what's the matter?" And I told her what had happened. And she didn't start screaming, and she didn't start hollering, and she didn't say, "Why are you destroying our lives? Why are you destroying our marriage? Why are you doing any of that kind of stuff?" Instead, the miracle of Al-Anon had worked in her life, and she sat down across the dining room table from me, and she looked at me for a long time. And then she put her hand out, and she touched the side of my face, and she said, "Oh, Sean, I'm so sorry that you have to hurt yourself so much." And then after a while, she said, "You know, in order to be married to you, I have two requirements. I need you to be loyal, and I need you to be supportive. And if you can be those things, then I'll stay married to you because I love you. But if you can't be those things, I have to leave because I love you." And so I had to make a decision. And I decided to stay married to that woman, and we rebuilt our relationship, and it's gone on and it's gotten better. But what I am is loyal and supportive to that woman. I don't have to approve of the things that she does. I don't have to approve of some of the decisions. I mean, she does some wacko things, that lady, you know. But by God, I support her ability to do those things, or whatever she wants to do, you know, and she does the same for me. And that's what Tradition 5 is. Our family doesn't endorse, finance, or lend our family name to any outside enterprise without consulting the family. You know, I don't get our family involved in stuff without their approval. 6 years ago, 7 years ago now, we moved to Vancouver. It was an opportunity for me in business, but it meant uprooting the family. And so what we did was we sat down as a family and I said, "Let's go up to Vancouver." Let's go there before this thing starts, before we have to make the decision, and let's look at the city. Let's look and see if we can live there, if we can do that. So the three of us went. We checked into a hotel, and we stayed there for a week, and we checked out the city. We went all over the place. Kate was 5 years old. Now, she found a water park that she fell in love with, so I had her clinched, you know. And Bonnie looked around, and we went to meetings, and we saw what it was going to be like, and we just sat down as a family, and we decided, yeah, it was going to be okay, that we should give it a shot. And we did that because it affected the entire family. And we are constantly looking at you know, when we're, you know, things get better in Alcoholics Anonymous. Things get better, and you know, suddenly there's like spendable cash. I mean, there's the ability to make investments. There's all kinds of stuff to do. You know, first of all, when you work 40 hours a week, what a concept, you know? You know, when you actually are not spending an enormous amount of money on alcohol and drugs, you know, or bail, you know, God, I mean, it's just amazing. You know, the extra cash there is sometimes, it's just incredible, you know? And we talk about that and how to do it and keep reminding ourselves that we live by spiritual principles, that we can't get so off in a direction of trying to, you know, boy, if we make all the right investments, blah, 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 you know. I'm always, you know what I'm doing? I got to tell you. I keep hoping one day that I will have worked this program enough, that I've done the 12 steps enough and the traditions enough, and I've sponsored enough guys and I've been to enough meetings, that I'll get to a plateau where I can just relax. You know, I get to that place where I can, and I won't have to work the program anymore. You know, I can just kind of coast. Doesn't happen in the first 20 years, I got to tell you that, you know. Keep looking for it, though. God. Yeah. So I got to continue to live by the spiritual principles. And our family has to be self-supporting through its own contributions. And I think that's really important. Because I'm a grandiose drunk, you know. And I got to look at whether my grandiosity is putting my family in any kind of financial problems. Now, in my sobriety, I've been rich and I've been poor. I prefer the problems of being rich to the problems of being poor. But they all have problems, let me tell you. And it doesn't matter how many cars or paintings or furniture or any of that stuff that you accumulate, it doesn't protect you and it doesn't fix you. But I got to look at those kind of times. You know, am I doing everything possible to make my family live comfortably? Am I putting food on the table and paying the rent? And that's my responsibility and I take it. And in those times when I haven't been able to, if I have to borrow money from somebody, do I make sure that there's a clear cut plan on how to pay that person back that is agreed to beforehand, before that actually happens? And if I do have to avail myself of any kind of government support, am I making every effort possible to become employed and get off of that? Because I believe that's the seventh tradition. And I was taught that in a way that was tough for me. My first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous was a very, very important man to me. He taught me everything that I believed in. The only problem was that I was to find out well into my sobriety, well after 10 years of sobriety, that there were parts of it that he didn't believe in. And he ended up owing me $62,000. And I'm still waiting for an envelope with $5 in it, which is how he taught me to make my amends. But it hasn't happened. And he taught me all the wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous, and we learn a lot from positive example, but we also learn from negative example. And what it taught me was that if I sponsor you or I 12-step you, you owe me nothing. You owe me absolutely nothing. I don't save anybody's life. I am merely a messenger. The message saves people's lives. And there are people in this fellowship who do that. There are people who prey on people who are vulnerable and very, very grateful. And I unfortunately was one of those ones that happened to. So the seventh tradition is very, very important in my family life, that I am self-supporting, that our family is self-supporting. And I also have to look and see if my family is emotionally self-supporting. We are not a dependent family. About a year into this fellowship, with her working her Al-Anon program and me working my AA program, we had a huge revelation about our marriage. And the revelation was that we no longer needed each other. I didn't need her. I still don't need her. She doesn't need me. She's perfectly capable of living her life. Well, I mean, we were talking at the table. I mean, everyone needs a wife. Nobody needs a husband, for God's sake. Yeah. But we're together 25 years because we want to be. Because I, quite frankly, haven't found anybody else that I like any better. One of the reasons is that I stopped looking a number of years ago. You know? As John Ackerlin says, the way you stay married 25 years is you don't date anybody else, you know? What a concept. And what we're trying to do is make Kate an independent human being with opinions and rights of her own, and she has them, and she voices them. I have to remain forever non-professional, but we may employ special workers. I have to understand that, you know, I got 20 years of sobriety, and I sponsor a lot of guys, and I know how this program works, but that does not make me an expert in everything. It does not make me an expert in psychology or medicine or finances or anything else, you know. I have got to have enough humility as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous to understand at times we need lawyers, we need specialists, we need doctors, we need tax people, we need other experts. I am not the end-all and the be-all of everything, you know. And our family ought never be organized. But we do have responsibilities to each other. And that came up. We had a problem with Kate a couple of years ago. Kate's room... Oh, God. Kate's room looks like, it's unbelievably horrible, you know. And it was driving Bonnie nuts. It was just making her crazy. And we were all starting to get nuts behind it because it was just a mess, you know. And I luckily sponsor a guy who owns two teenage boys. So I was telling him what a problem we were having with Kate. I mean, the room is unbelievable. I mean, her room looks like it's been burglarized on a daily basis. You know? And he said, well, listen, does the room smell? And I said, no. And he said, well, does the condition of the room affect your property value? And I said, no. He said, well, those are the only criteria. And, you know, that's it, you know. So what we did was we sat down, we had a family conference, and what we agreed is that she could keep her room in any condition she wanted to, provided we could close the door. But the community rooms that we all lived in, the living room, the den, the kitchen, and all that, had to be kept clean. We had the responsibility to each other to do that, but in our own rooms we could do whatever we wanted. So that's how we worked that one out. And we do that kind of stuff. We have no opinion on outside issues. Our family has no opinion on outside issues. Our family is based on the principle of live and let live. I got no opinion about your religion. Our family is colorblind. Our family lives by the principle that we're all human beings and that we're all on our own journey. And it's been real important, you know, because Kate's in a situation now. She's 12 years old, you know, and she's going to school, and they're doing all that kind of thing of, you know, they make fun of people who are different. And what's extraordinary is Kate lives in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because she lives in Alcoholics Anonymous, she lives with people who are different all the time, you know. There's every wild, wacko kind of human being going in and out of our house. You know, there's everything going in and out of our house. So so it makes her real uncomfortable when the rest of the kids do that kind of stuff. And we talk about that a lot. And that's the principle that we live by, is that we just got no opinion about it. You know, it's fine for you, but this is how we live our life. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. You know, when we're first sober and we're first in that first year of sobriety and that first kind of blush of sobriety and the rush of the 12 steps and our lives are getting better, you know, what we tend to do is go to, you know, family Thanksgiving with a big book under our arms and say, all right, these are the principles we're going to live by now. This whole family is going to get sober and serene. We're all going to go to family week and you're going to have an analgesic bath, you know, oh God, you know. And you know what? They don't have to change. They don't have to change because they don't think they have to change. If they thought they had to change, they'd change. It ain't up to me to point out their character defects. It's not up to me to take their inventory. What it is up to me is to practice the principles in all my affairs. So what I do is I be sober. I be sober. I asked my sponsor when I was newly sober, how am I going to make amends to my family? He said, you're going to be sober. And a long, long time from now, they're going to acknowledge that. But they are going to remain unimpressed with your progress for years and years and years because they're going to be waiting for the other shoe to drop. And so, I'm sober. What I am now is I'm not so much a guy who can't drink for the people around me, I'm a guy who doesn't drink. And it's real interesting. Being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is not the first piece of information I give to people when I meet them. Because what I found is a lot of times that's a way of getting special treatment. You know? And I don't want that. I think it's basically in bad taste to discuss your medical problems at dinner parties, you know? And I think alcoholism is a medical problem. What I am is a human being who doesn't drink. And eventually, once I get to know people and once I've been working in an environment and all that kind of stuff, when it logically kind of comes up, then I'll tell them, you know, what they need to know. If somebody, you know, it's funny, you're in a social situation and somebody says, do you want to drink? You say, no, thank you. You know, and say, oh, you don't drink? No, I don't, you know. Did you used to? Yeah. Well, how long has it been since you haven't had a drink? Well, going on 20 years. Oh, yeah? Did you have a problem with it? Yeah. What kind of problem? I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you want to go to a meeting or something? I mean, you were going to... Yeah. You need to know about this? Or that, you know? I believe the most effective 12-step work we can do is not obviously be alcoholic. And then step 12 is anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our family. And it really is, you know. The idea that there's no one member of our family that dominates the family. At first in sobriety, of course, I was the one that dominated the family because I was the one that was so ill